In-depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, January 18th, 2012, on 2013 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I keep doing that. Happy Friday afternoon to you, and thank you for listening to the Federal News Countdown today. Every week at this time, two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose what they think are the three most important news stories of the week to people who work for the federal government, rank them in order, and then come in and count them down on the Federal News Countdown. And this week, my experts are Jason Miller of Federal News Radio, the executive editor. Good to see you. And we have not yet seen your compadre on the countdown yet, Dan Chenick, the executive director of the IBM Center for the Business of Government, headed here after a meeting, and he's going to be joining us shortly. But we will get started, as we always do, on the countdown with
number three.
Jason, your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is our colleague Jack Moore's story, headline, House Bill Blocks Pay Increase for Feds. And I'm not sure, at least from my perspective, if it's so much the actual content of the bill and the prospects that the bill has, as it is the fact that this is obviously going to be on the agenda for the 113th Congress, same way as it was before.
I'm absolutely in agreement with you, and that's why I picked this. This bill is not going to go anywhere. They're going to vote on it next Wednesday. It's going to pass probably a typical party line vote. Republicans, yes. Democrats, no, for the most part. And then it will go to the Senate, and the Senate will just let it die once again. And then they'll try again and again and again. And I just think that the reason why I picked this as the third most important story of the week is it's a signal that once again, federal employees are going to be facing these constant attacks against their pay. And I know the unions, AFGE and NTU specifically, have come out very strongly against this. You have some of the local members of Congress, Denny Hoyer, Frank Wolf, Jim Moran, Chris Van Hollen, Senators Mikulski and Cardin and Warner have all come out against these type of pay. Yet nothing ever seems to happen around the education of what it means when you try to freeze federal pay and the education of, hey, this isn't really but a drop in the bucket when you're talking about deficits and problems. So I see it as both a once again, another signal that this is going to be on the agenda, but also as a failing by the local members and people, not just the local members either, but the people who have large constituents of federal employees in their districts in San Diego, in Denver, in Philadelphia, in Boston, in Seattle. They're failing too.
The thing about this that I found most interesting, he's got 28 co-sponsors, Jack writes, among them Congressman Darrell Issa, chairman of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. And Issa said the planned pay increase would apply to all federal employees, even those receiving poor performance reviews. And my sense is that we're not even – maybe we're going about it backwards. Maybe we look at some kind of reform for the pay system where the poor performers wouldn't get the raises. There's a lot of different ways you could slice this unless you were trying to make some point.
It's the old taking a hatchet where maybe a knife would do. And I think that's part of the failures of the local and then the others, but specifically the local congressmen and senators who have not done a good enough job in educating. And here's what I think it says to me as well is it's not important enough for them to do that. It's not it's important for them to come out and shake the tree when things are bad, but the day in and day out, exactly, get off my lawn.
Yeah.
But don't put the fence up to keep people off your lawn in the meantime.
That's what I've done in my house. Jason Miller's third most important federal news story of the week is Jack Moore's story, headline, House Bill Blocks Pay Increase for Feds. Dan Chenick is here, the executive director of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. It's great to see you, my friend.
Thanks, Francis. It's great to be here.
Your number three most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. The headline is Tangerlini Plans 10 Strategic Sourcing Efforts by 2015. And this kind of fits with something that Jason and I talked about earlier in the week, which is Dan Tangerlini is certainly, for somebody who's an acting administrator, certainly doing an awful lot of things that acting administrators don't normally do. And I wonder if we can derive some kind of message from that.
So I'm not going to try to predict what will happen, but what I will say is that Dan has really done a lot over the last year to turn GSA in different directions, positive directions across a variety of areas. The reason that I picked this story is because it's actually the first of a theme. Rather than think about things that happened this week, it's things that are happening over the next 4 years. And through Dan's efforts, through the efforts of GSA, they're taking really a new look at sourcing, looking at how do we strategically help agencies, we being GSA in this case, buy products and services more effectively and efficiently in different ways from the private sector. How do we think about improving the acquisition workforce? That's something that all members of the government acquisition stakeholder community, whether you're in government or whether you're selling to the government, have a stake in.
That's one of the elements of the strategy that he released. That's really posted on his blog, and we have a story about that on federalnewsradio.com. But that's just one of the things that he's listing as a priority for that agency over the next couple of years.
That's right. I think that there's an excellent team of leaders that's been working with the acting administrator, Dave McClure, Casey Coleman, the CIO, Kathleen Turco at Government-Wide Policy, Mary Davey, who's acting as the FAS commissioner, Dorothy Robine, the Public Building Services commissioner, and there's more there that are part of that team. But he's got an excellent set of leaders that I think have laid out a great agenda going forward.
I think one of the things, the reason why he decided to write the blog now, because the 10 areas were actually laid out at the President's Management Advisory Board meeting, I want to say like November timeframe, but I think what pushed him to write the blog now was that they are having this industry day coming up January 30th around janitorial and sanitation services. And I think they're really trying to promote it and get people interested and understanding what's going on. Because the stories I've done and the people I've talked with, there's a lot of concern in the small business community about the impact strategic sourcing is going to have or could have on small businesses. And I think Tangerlini's playing a little bit of a let me get out ahead of it game here to make sure if he can ease some fears or some concerns. I don't know if you see that from where you sit at IBM.
Well, strategic sourcing is often better sourcing. It's not necessarily that it's pro or anti any particular group of people that would sell to the government. And so I think that I agree with Jason that by getting out in front, GSA can really try to set the agenda and calm some fears.
All right, Dan, your third most important federal news story of the week is Tangerlini plans 10 strategic sourcing efforts by 2015. You can read it now. It's from FCW, and it's linked up on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The second most important federal news stories of the week from Jason Miller and Dan Chenick when the countdown continues on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Giving you the edge on healthy living, here's Mayo Clinic Medical Edge. Gout is an extremely painful and sometimes disabling ailment. What happens with gout is there's a buildup of uric acid crystals in and around joints. Traditionally, physicians check for gout by using a needle to draw fluid from around the affected joints to check for crystals, but
we often see patients that have been labeled with, for instance, rheumatoid arthritis or some other type of inflammatory arthritis because initial routine testing looking at the joint fluid had missed the correct diagnosis.
Mayo Clinic Dr. Tim Bongartz recently led a study which found use of high-tech images, CT scans, can help confirm a diagnosis if gout is suspected.
Patients who had ongoing symptoms for quite a while, already had an aspiration that was negative, but the physician is still suspecting a high likelihood of gout. I think that would be the right patient for doing the test.
For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org. I'm Tracy McRae.
Enjoy the comedy of Emmy Award-winning Dana Carvey and dance the night away to the sounds of Jim Belushi and the Sacred Hearts at the 26th Annual Leukemia Ball. It's presented by Bio in partnership with Genentech, Saturday, March 23rd. Take part in a fabulous auction and a chance to win one of two Mercedes-Benz. DC's largest non-political fundraiser supports the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society's critical research and patient services programs. For sponsorship opportunities or to purchase raffle tickets, visit leukemiaball.org.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
General William Shelton, who heads the Air Force Space Command and oversees the Air Force's cyber operation, says Iran responded to a 2010 cyber attack on its nuclear facilities by beefing up its own cyber capabilities. And he said in his own words, they will be a force to be reckoned with. He declined to comment, though, about Iran's ability to disrupt U.S. government computer networks. And it's widely believed Iran has hacked into U.S. banks in recent months. I'm J.J. Green.
Airmen, we're on our way.
At EADS North America, we help our country respond to emergencies and natural disasters.
We see you. We're coming in.
From coordinating communications to medevac and emergency response, we provide the mission-critical systems our country demands. Every day, we support homeland security and defense missions here at home and around the globe.
Patient secure. ETA 10 minutes.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says rural America is becoming less relevant. But what is USDA doing to change that? I'm Emily Kopp. We'll find out on Friday's Federal Drive. And we'll look at We the People, where the people file online petitions asking the White House to do all sorts of things. But is the government listening? It all starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, it's Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller. And we're up to...
Number two!
And Jason, your second most important federal news story of the week, coincidentally... I actually did plan it. Headline: GSA's Tangerlini sets new priorities as part of reform efforts. And I mentioned the six priorities that he posted in a blog post this week, and you are writing about them in this story. And again, I'm not sure that my take on this is that the priorities, that it's so much the priorities, it is the fact that he's laying them out as the acting administrator and yet still setting the course for where he thinks the agency should be headed.
And in fact, I'm going to even go even broader, very similar to our first story that we talked about. I'm using this as an example of what we're seeing throughout the government is of cabinet members deciding to stay or go. I mean, if you had some music set up, we could say, if you know, should I stay or should I go? And Tangerlini, I think, is saying, should I stay right here? Look, I want to stay. If the White House wants me, I'm here, I think, for the long haul. I think you're seeing that with DHS Secretary Napolitano. You're seeing that with Attorney General Holder. And then you're seeing people leaving, like Interior Secretary Salazar, which, you know, the rumor mill is pretty hot on who would replace him. Would be John Barry from OPM has been the rumor mill. So that would be a fun replacement if that happened. And then you also have other people, like, for instance, at OMB. Dan won't comment because he still can't pulled himself away from being at OMB, that he's not there anymore. But, you know, who's going to replace Jeff Zients? And who's going to replace the deputy director for management? And all these positions that are starting to really pop up, once you get rid of, you know, kind of, if you will, defense and state and CIA, you know, kind of really the big ones in Treasury, what's the next level? And Tangerlini, I think, is at that next level.
Well, and that's actually, Dan, been kind of the buzz that I've been hearing this week is GSA really at that second level? And if it's not, it should be. I mean, some of the folks who really follow GSA are not as confident as Jason is that GSA is as high on the administration's radar screen as they would like to see it be. You know, some of the other cabinet level officials. And yet the general consensus seems to be, yes, GSA is really important, but maybe not as high profile as some of the other cabinet level secretaries. And so might not be getting the attention.
Well, I think anytime there's a second term scenario, there's a cadence to the order in which nominees get named or nominees or current secretaries agree to stay and their team. And I think this administration, clearly the national security team is often first, and then the domestic economic teams, and it proceeds from there. I think the important point is that the administrator, Dan Tangerlini, and other people both who are staying and also people who are acting in their jobs, who are still basically in the jobs until the administration determines what to do, are continuing to carry out the duties of the office, continuing to set an agenda in the GSA case, continuing to basically try to lay a foundation for a future of an agency that went through some difficult times, for a couple of years and is now doing a number of things that are moving forward.
And I think that's why this, from a story standpoint, when I worked on the story, when I took the angle that I took, it said to me, it really spoke to me that Dan Tarantino is going to stay, or he wants to stay longer. I don't know about your experience, Dan. I mean, you've been this longer than I have. Do you get the impression that if he wasn't having a long-term vision, that maybe he wouldn't be so bold with strategies and bold with priorities, because the next administrator, let's say it's not him, could come in and change everything. So why put it out in the first place? I mean, is that what your experience tells you around that?
So actually, I take a different view. I don't know what Dan's plans are or the future of the office, but I think that any time you're in a job and you have basically a foundation that you're laying, and as a career deputy, I often try to exercise this when I was at OMB. You want to lay a foundation so that either your team or whoever comes after you can pick up and hit the ground running with a strong base to build on, and I think that's what this set of activity demonstrates.
And the list is pretty non-controversial for what the mission of the General Services Administration is. So it's not like he's going out on some limb where somebody else might come in at some point in time and say, well, we shouldn't be doing that at all. These are all pretty core principles to the agency: delivering better value, saving money, serving our partners, expanding opportunities for small businesses, sustainable government, more sustainable government, leading with innovation, building a stronger agency.
Very, very similar to Martha Johnson's priorities too, which I kind of made that recognition that, you know, she was very big into the green and telework, but if you read through his priorities, a lot of them are, you know, GSA needs to be a leader around innovation. That's something Martha Johnson said many times. So I think from a GSA perspective, it's as much fine-tuning as brand new priorities.
All right. The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Jason Miller, is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline: GSA's Tangerlini sets new priorities as part of reform efforts. And that and all of our stories in the countdown linked up now on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Chenick's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week when we come back on the Federal News Countdown.
WTOP and the Washington Wizards are looking for the best junior broadcaster in D.C. Your child can join me, Dave Johnson, along with Glenn Consor, as we call the Wizards-Houston Rockets game Saturday, February 23rd at Verizon Center. Plus, you'll get 4 tickets to the game and dinner in the press room. To enter, kids between the ages of 8 and 14 can submit an essay telling us why they should become our Wizards junior broadcaster. We're taking entries through January 18th. For all the rules, details, and to enter, visit WTOP.com, search junior broadcaster. Good luck.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does 3 decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers: distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time, but the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit CapitalAreaFoodBank.org.
This week I've been looking at solar chargers for my iPhone. Last week I was out and about and my iPhone went dead as a doornail. And I thought to myself, you know, there's all this sunlight. Why couldn't I get a solar charger for this? And there are a number of solar chargers out there. Now, the charge time varies anywhere from 6 hours to 12 hours, depending on which one you get. But at least you can get something going.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Trust your home and family safety to Ackerman Security Systems. Why Ackerman? Because security is what they do, and they do it better than anyone else. You can control your system remotely, get texts, emails, even video clips of events going on around your home. Whether you need a basic system at $18.95 a month or the latest technology, call Ackerman Security today and get up to 3 months of basic monitoring free. 888-999-1070. AckermanSecurity.com.
For over a century, Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington has served the youth in our nation's capital. The club's new STEAM initiative uses the arts to teach science, technology, engineering, and math. Today, more than ever, we need your support of STEAM. It will encourage our youth to think rather than memorize, create rather than copy, and to be resourceful rather than reserved. So visit boysandgirlsclubs.org. Send a dollar or more as an investment to help us help our kids pick up STEAM. Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington. Great futures start here.
This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
Medicine in a storm. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS Health Beat. Don't become a patient because you don't have your medicine. Make it a part of your go bag, a set of supplies you need during a natural disaster. If you take regular medication, you may not be able to get to the pharmacy or medical facility for an extended period, and you don't want to be in an emergency room when you can control it. At HHS, Ed Gabriel tells us to plan ahead.
So you talk to your physician, and you explain to that physician what you need and what you take, and ask them to provide a little bit more of it so that you can use during a disaster. 10 days of it or so is important.
In addition to medicines you need, include these items in your go bag: a first aid kit, warm clothing, food, water, paper towels, and more. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS Health Beat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown with the three most important federal news stories of the week. Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and executive editor from Federal News Radio, Jason Miller here. And Dan, your second most important federal news story of the week is from AOL Government. The headline is Rethinking the Debt Ceiling, Fund Deficits, Not Accumulated Debt. And it might sound on the surface like this is kind of a move the boxes around story, but this goes a lot deeper than that when it comes to how the government operates.
So this continues my theme of thinking about big things for the next 4 years with three stories. It also continues my theme about only have stories about current or former OMB employees. And Doug Criscitiello is another former OMB examiner who was later the chief financial officer at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And he is now in the private sector and has written a very thoughtful piece that's not necessarily the end-all, be-all answer, but it's a way of thinking about how to approach restructuring the debt over time and how to think about budgeting in that sense, and thinking about, well, maybe if you set aside a piece of the debt and basically reset budgeting and think about budgeting in different types of fiscal years from a deficit-to-deficit perspective, you could get a more rational result and then think about retiring the debt as a separate matter.
The idea of the debt seems to be one that we're not really focused on a lot. Everybody's talking about the deficit and then, of course, the shorter-term budget problems that we're having primarily based around what's going on the Hill. What do you think has to happen to kind of change that dynamic? It's not, with all due respect to Mr. Criscitiello, and you're right, this is a very thoughtful piece. This and this alone, these kinds of things alone are not going to turn that dialogue, I don't think.
That's right. But I think ideas like this, ideas like different ways of thinking about how to creatively finance major entitlement programs, how to creatively structure agency budgets, multi-year budgets, capital budgets. The more that we talk about this as a community, the more that over time, this problem isn't going to be solved tomorrow. It probably won't be solved over the next several years. But over the next several years, we can develop a consensus that can create to a path forward. If you look at the path of the 80s and 90s, it took a long time for deficit funded government to turn back into surplus. And then quickly we turned back into a government where deficits were growing again. And now we need creative thinking again to think about how do we move back towards surplus.
I get the impression, though, that Congress is so worked up on the political issues that this type of common sense is this, hey, let's think about things differently, is just going to get stuck in the data in, there's no data coming back out. And is there anything that agencies, the question I would have for Mr. Criscitiello is there anything that agencies can do to address some of the debt and deficit issues from their end, not from a, you know, well, if we cut this, we'll help with the deficit. I mean, they're doing that anyways. But like, what are the steps that internally that agencies can take to prepare for the budget reductions and for the changes that could come with sequestration?
Yeah, I think that, and this is where I guess the former career staffer Pollyanna side of me comes out. First of all, agencies, as they're developing their budgets, if they're thinking about looking to results, and some of the work that OMB's been leading with the agency performance officers is trying to more sustainably tie these priority goals to budget decisions, where they can demonstrate to Congress, here is what you're getting for your money in a real way, a measurable way. So that's one piece. And then really identifying the different choices that are available and using the analysis tools as opposed to the purely political tools, Jason, as you talked about, to try to demonstrate those choices and make clear the ramifications of one path versus another. That's the best path that I think an agency can take, is to try to make sense across and amid this very a politically driven conversation, and properly so. We are in Washington. It's a town where politics is often the order of the day, but good analysis can often illuminate choices that political officials can make.
Yeah, that I guess, as I heard you describe it, that's my concern too. These are five steps that you can sit here and read and separate the ideology out of them, and you can see that establishing these steps would be doable. But the idea, the way the tenor, the tone is on Capitol Hill right now, that's, I guess, what I have a hard time seeing, is them being able to take that next step and say, yes, even within this framework, can we agree on any of these elements that go into this? And I'm a little more skeptical.
Well, so the
there,
question is, do you basically say, well, we can't do anything about it because of the issues that you're raising, mm-hmm. or can we try to make as much progress as we can given the issues, and then over time move toward a more sensible treatment of budget issues, debt and deficit, et cetera? It's similar to a piece that we wrote out of the Center for the Business of Government a few months ago around managing to reduce the deficit issues over time, that agencies can take a tip from the private sector and manage better to save money, just as companies have done. And that's a way to demonstrate to Congress that agencies can actually take action.
The two things that come to mind kind of that we're kind of addressing is there's got to be some leadership from the Hill around this. And I'm not sure there is right now, because I think too many people are either A, being drowned out by the political discussions, or B, nobody is being in a position. So let me give you an example. So Senator Mikulski from Maryland is now the head of the Appropriations Committee. Someone like her, I know Senator Warner from Virginia was leading not only a performance caucus, but also part of the budget caucus, the idea of performance and budget. Someone like that's got to step forward and get some, not just respect, but some attention and get it going. And then they have to find a House counterpart to jump into as well. Somebody who is not an ideologue, and somebody who can preferably, if you have a Democrat in the Senate, maybe a Republican in the House, that can then kind of talk about this idea of not just marrying the performance budget issue, but also, well, maybe we're doing too much. Maybe as a government, if we're going to need to reduce the budget, we need to reduce what we expect from agencies. And maybe it's not services, but to the public per se, but maybe it's some of the reports and some of the things on the peripheral that make a little bit of a difference. But in time, they can kind of start using that as a point that they can agree on, and then kind of move toward the bigger stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think if the administration and Congress work together, and the administration comes forward with interesting ideas and has discussions with staff and with members that are interested in moving forward, I think that the type of direction that you're describing is achievable.
Well, let me example, a story that popped out, I guess, on Friday was the administration decision that there's 376 reports that are not needed anymore, could be consolidated, could be changed in some way. That seems like a no-brainer on the Hill, right? Now, I know each of the report maybe has a constituent or somebody wants it for some reason, but if you can rationally talk about that, that would be what I mean on the mm-hmm. peripheral to start. And how hard would that be for someone on Capitol Hill? Even the most conservative, fiscal conservative person there is could say, yeah, I could see we don't need 200 of those or 150 of those. But the question is, will they ever get to that point where they both can come together and start with something small and then work to the bigger things?
Yeah, that's an interesting example. When I was in the government, there were similar exercises where the administrations would propose eliminating reports. And it does work through a process, as all issues do when they get brought through the administration into the Congress. And in the end of the day, I think that some portion of those 400 or 376 probably will be eliminated in some omnibus reports elimination action of some sort, and not all. And that's the nature of how the system works.
And just as an aside, one of your favorite reports is on the eliminated list, the e-government reports.
Yes, I'm well familiar with that.
I will miss that one if they eliminate it. I'm going to have to lobby against it. I love the e-government report.
Yeah, that report was not called for by the e-government act.
No, that was an add-on.
Developed by Karen Evans. After a couple of years, because of questions that had been raised from different committees in the Congress about various different e-government projects. And so the administration basically said, we'll put it all in one report and we'll send it up.
The second most important federal news story of the week is from Dan Chenick, is from IBM. Dan is from the IBM Center for the Business of Government. His second most important story is from AOL Government. The headline is Rethinking the Debt Ceiling, Fund Deficits Not Accumulated Debt, by Doug Criscitiello. And you can find it linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We're at the top of the chart this week. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Jason Miller and by Dan Chenick. Next on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
For secure computing in the office or on the go, the TacLane Multibook from General Dynamics delivers defense-grade security integrated into a Dell laptop. For the first time, you can simultaneously connect to secure and unsecure networks, even Skype with your friends and family from anywhere, anytime. Ideal for today's government workforce, the NSA-certified TacLane Multibook secure laptop keeps you mobile, connected, and protected. To learn more, visit www.gdc4s.com/multibook.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma, or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible.
March for Babies!
Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
What is the current state of morale in the federal workforce? Is it better or worse than it was a year ago? Federal News Radio is looking for your thoughts on morale in the federal government. Take our survey and tell us what you think are the biggest contributing factors to positive and negative morale. Do agency leaders have the tools they need to fix morale problems? Results of the survey will be included as part of a Federal News Radio special report in February. Find the survey at federalnewsradio.com. Search survey.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
Thanks for listening to the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This week, my experts choosing their most important federal news stories of the week, Jason Miller of Federal News Radio and Dan Chenick, the IBM Center for the Business of Government, and we are up to...
Number one!
And Dan Chenick, your most important federal news story of the week is headlined, Government Data Goes Public, but you have a little clarification on our report conversation.
Yes, continue with my OMB theme, which will continue into the next story. So I think that if memory serves, the report that was in the E-Government Act, which I mentioned at the end, was different than the report that was on the list, was folded into actually two different reports that are on the list. And so it's a complicated picture of e-government reports. And in the end, there may be some consolidation of those reports. We'll see how it goes.
You can't tell the reports without a scorecard. Now, your most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is Government Data Goes Public. And as you mentioned, your theme of what will happen over the next 4 years continues in this story.
That's right. And I think here you've got the OMB Chief Information Officer, Steve Van Roekel, talking at a conference this week about government data that was used to demonstrate value that went in, eventually went into valuation of companies as they went public. In this case, it was Trulia and Zillow and the work that they do and how they take advantage of government data in the same way that all of the weather channels that we watch on TV or the news stations take advantage of data that the National Weather Service puts out. And I think that what this shows is a continuation of the theme that's been developing over the last really 4 years since data.gov got started, of the government doing much more to make data available to the public and allowing the private sector and citizens to reuse that data, repackage it. I think that there is still growth to occur, especially in making the data easy to find and use, using technology to access it and package it, especially for those people that aren't major data brokers or data aggregators, but I think they're well on the road.
I hear three schools of thought about what this data should, what kinds of forms it should take in, to use your mark, the next 4 years. One is that the government should certainly, and all of them are based on the fact that the government should be in the as much data as possible business. But the focus seems to be on the collation and aggregation, as you were just talking about. One is that the government should be very heavily involved with that also through dashboards and other ways. The other one seems to be that they should be almost out of it entirely and not really involved, just supplying it and that's it. And then the third is kind of a hybrid of the three. Do you fall any particular place on that spectrum?
I guess I'm on the, I don't know that I'm on a hybrid as much as a combination of one and
okay,
three.
Okay, that might be a better way to put
and
it.
And so
yes.
I think that there's a role for the government to be the provider of data about the economy, society, the nature of government programs, the performance of those programs, how much money is spent, making that data available for people to analyze and businesses to use and trading partners to understand. There's also a government management function where it's easier to make it easier to understand how government programs are performing, to make it easier for government managers, for industry working with government to know how to access the acquisition system, how to understand where budget dollars are going. And there, are government putting things together in dashboards, as this administration has done quite often, or other things like that, are fine avenues to take as well. So it's really a combination of make as much data available as possible, but also understand what are the key roles of government and packaging that to help citizens understand.
And Dan's role there seems to be pretty logical. The government is the expert in how all of these things work, and so having a role in how that information is presented and shaped for presentation seems to be pretty logical.
And a lot of agencies are still trying to get past that idea that it doesn't have to be perfect data, it just has to be data. But what's missing here, I think, and not in Joe's story per se, but this idea of making data more open, is the policy that's coming from OMB around APIs and machine readable and things like that. That's the key. I mean, Todd Park talked about this about 2 weeks ago or so and said, you know, the policy's coming soon. And I think that's going to be the key. What does the policy say? What do agencies have to do to meet the goals of the policy, and how soon can they meet it? Because the data is fine. You can put it out there. But I think data.gov's missing piece has been making sure that the information is machine readable, that there's APIs connected or could be connected to it. And that's really going to spur the innovation that this administration, I think, is hoping for.
Now, I understand what you're saying.
You can
saying.
Disagree. It's
well,
okay.
About the quality of the data, I understand that, but I'm reading this, and you covered this speech by Stephen Van Roekel at NIST also. He said, we have government data that'll tell you, is there an organic farm within 25 miles of here? What's the quality of the medical care, quality of the schools? If you're a citizen and you're basing a home buying decision, you're not going to be real happy 5 years later with the idea of, well, the data wasn't quite as clean as we'd like it to be. So I wonder if the expectation of the citizen who pulls that information, regardless of what source they pull it from, and the expectation of the agency or government organization who justifiably can't verify every single piece of information, I wonder if those expectations aren't a little bit different, and at least maybe the agency, we should be mindful of that as we're starting to think through big data.
So life does not give us perfect certainty,
right,
in any setting, and data is one such setting, and there we can always look at improving data. And the thing that Jason talked about is the fact that tools like this, which are commonly used by companies, IBM, many other companies use analytics, big data, to try to make sense of a vast trove of business information. And tools like this will allow people to interface with government and will allow agencies to provide services and to make available that data so that people who interface with the government can basically take similar actions to become more effective.
The other piece of this as well is when they put the data out that's imperfect with these, by making it machine readable and attaching APIs to it, the private sector can then correct the data and send, well, you know, you said that the broadband speed was 5 gigabytes per second. It's really 7 now. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. It changed in the last week. And that's what I think the other hope is for as well.
I guess, I'm not disagreeing with either one of you about the reasonableness of understanding that there's a tolerance to the accuracy of the data potentially. I'm just saying that I don't know that the average person who's going to use data coming from the government who doesn't understand that will buy into it when someone tries to explain it to them.
But the average person's not going to use it. It's the companies that are going to use it.
Well, but I'm not sure that's the case. No, if private sector companies start to harness this data, as Dan alluded to with the Weather Service and all these other kinds of data, if this information gets collected and you go on Zillow and you decide you want to buy a house because the data that it has indicates this, and that doesn't turn out to be the case, you're going to be an unhappy camper because you're not going to understand that
tolerance. I think the government does have a responsibility and actually a statutory requirement under the Data Quality Act to continue to try to improve the data as much as possible. What these tools can do is help citizens understand that, all right, if this source says something and I can validate it against this source, and I can, through APIs or interfaces, through my web browser, right at my computer, just like I go online to do an e-commerce buy from Amazon.com or I communicate with my friends over some social network, I can basically do a very simple calculation, put two databases together, and validate that information so I can make a decision.
The other piece I'll throw out to you, Francis, is on your example is, if you're buying a house and you're using one of these sites and the site gives you wrong data, you're not mad at the government, you're mad at the site. And eventually the site, if they A, don't clean up their data, or B, go back to the government with, hey, this data wasn't what we thought it was, here's some suggestions to improve it. And then, you know, HUD goes, oh, I didn't realize we could improve it that way, or oh, that's a great way to improve it. I think you're putting the government in a spot that they're actually not there. It's the companies there. Like the weather data, it was supposed to snow in the DC area. How's that snow working out, right? We're all mad at the weathermen, not NOAA or National Weather Service.
My kids are so disappointed.
No, your kids aren't the only ones.
The weathermen. or a woman.
Yeah, Dan Chenick's most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is, Government Data Goes Public. It's linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Jason Miller. We'll wrap up our federal news countdown for this week next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Take your big ideas off the back burner. With HP Converged Infrastructure Solutions, you can spend most of your time and IT budget on your mission instead of IT operations. Servers, storage, networking, security, and management software work together to accelerate IT, greatly reduce application provisioning time, and get you ready for the cloud. Plan your strategy with HP Consulting for faster implementation and execution. The power of HP Converged Infrastructure is here. Learn more at hp.com/go/federal.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
The Bible says the borrower is slave to the lender. In other words, when you owe people money, they own you. So are you tired of being a slave to your mortgage and all your other debts? Just think, a typical monthly mortgage payment is 90% or more interest, and the banks get it all. Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. I've shown over 2 million people how to eliminate their debts, including their mortgage, credit card debts, car payments, and student loans. And now I want to show you. So let me rush you a free copy of the Debt-Free Bible. Just call 1-800-400-8380. You'll discover powerful debt-eliminating secrets that will help you break free from being a slave to your debts. The truth is, you can get out of debt, no matter how much money you owe or how much money you make. For a free copy of the Debt-Free Bible, call now while a limited number of copies are still available. Call 1-800-400-8380. For your debt-free Bible, call 1-800-400-8380.
come back to Foggy Bottom for homecoming at the George Washington University on February 9th and 10th in 2013. Join GW Men's Basketball on Saturday, February 9th, when they take on the Butler Bulldogs and commemorate the 20th anniversary of their trip to the Sweet 16. The GW Women play Butler on Sunday and celebrate the 40th anniversary of Title IX. Visit gwsports.com/homecoming and get your homecoming tickets today.
Working together, keeping the nation safe, is the focus of AFSEA's 12th annual Homeland Security event, February 26th through 28th at the Grand Hyatt Washington. Speakers from all levels of government, military, and industry will dialogue on cybersecurity, critical infrastructure protection, identity management, information and intelligence sharing, emergency management, mobile communications, and more. Register to attend or exhibit at AFSEA.org, keyword homeland. That's AFSEA.org, keyword homeland.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Federal News Countdown, featuring the three most important federal news stories of the week. This week, it's Jason Miller of Federal News Radio and Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And Jason, your most important federal news story of the week is Jack Moore's story, headlined, OMB tells agencies to intensify sequestration planning. And I think the word intensify is maybe my favorite word in this entire story.
Well, this, again, this, I think Dan's theme was, not just this week, but looking forward over the next 3 to 4 years. My theme, I think, for my stories were they each of them are a smaller microcosm of a bigger issue. And I think I could have picked Jack's story or any number of Jared Serbu's DOD stories about the ramping up of sequestration planning, even though it's 6 weeks, 7 weeks away. I think it's all a part of the, for lack of a better word, game that's being played on Capitol Hill in the executive branch around, look how bad this is going to be. Don't let this happen. And this is such a use of time and resources that could be better used that it's a little disappointing, at least from where I sit, that it's going to go up to the last minute again, and my guess is they'll fix it somehow, or sequestration will happen for a week or for a couple days, but they'll eventually figure it out. But it's just this constant kind of echo of got to do it. You got to, it's going to happen. Look what's going to happen to us. Like today, Jack Moore wrote a story about the Army instituting a hiring freeze and other cuts. Jared Serbu heard from, Undersecretary Wark from the Navy yesterday at a conference regarding, what the Navy is going to do, what it means, less time for ships to be on the ocean and sailing, less training. And I think they're pointing this out, and rightly so, about what could happen, but how much effort and resources is happening to figure all that out is what's kind of like, I think the main theme of this.
What do you see when you look at this? What I see is when the sequestration deadline was January 2nd, the agencies and OMB and the Pentagon said right up until the last minute, we're not going to plan for this. This is really bad. It can't happen. Congress will fix it, and so on. This time around, it's a totally different thing. Is there something to that, do you think, or is it just a different approach this time, and that's really all there is to that?
So there's been a lot of this over the last 20 years, maybe not at the same scale that we have now, but continuing resolutions, shutdowns have been around since the early 90s. And the government has grown to understand it. There is a cost to it. There was actually a report that our center put out on the cost of late appropriations that examined this issue. But I try to separate sort of the churn that Jason described that administrations always go through. From the longer-term issue, which is regardless of how the sequestration issues are resolved, the government will have limited resources for now and for the foreseeable future. And so understanding how to make choices about what government programs should continue and how they should be continued to make more sense to get better results for less money is more important than ever. And so if you think of over the long term, it's more important to think about how – as a company or an agency, the work that you're doing can be made more efficient and with less resources than to think about, what's the next deadline that I have to worry about?
See, that sounds to me – the reason I think that's insightful is because it sounds to me like you're saying we're asking the wrong questions.
Yes.
We're asking the question, what's going to happen next, or what is this –
this individual item mean, rather than asking those questions that you're talking
but
about.
But I'd even take it one step further. I think that this intensified planning for sequestration, all these DOD memos that are coming out from the services and OSD, is creating this hurry up and wait effect of, oh, it's going to come, we got to hurry up and do stuff. While, in fact, I did a story earlier in the week with the Navy CIO, Terry Halverson, who's part of the DOD broad efficiency initiatives, is to cut 5% of his IT budget a year for 5 years for 25% cut. And he's going about it much more meticulously, really looking at issues and saying, can we afford this? Is there a way we could be more efficient? Can we take printers off people's desks so there's one main printer instead of 10 individual ones? Can we relook at our cell phone contracts and do a better job of managing the devices and the services? And if Dan only uses 5 minutes a month and Francis uses 40 minutes a month, maybe Francis needs the different plan than Dan does, that type of thing. That's the way they should be going about this, not this, you know, freeze everything, major cuts to this, and which all comes from this last minuteness of the sequestration and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
And I think you've seen OMB make statements to that effect as well, that it's much more intelligent to really think about the budget in terms of what's performing, where do we want to make investments, and where do we want to cut, and have a longer-term conversation than it is to take an across-the-board view, which doesn't have those kinds of rewards and penalties for.
I've identified very few people who think that it's a good idea. There are some, not many, and yet we still are faced with this situation.
Well, that's why I think it's going to end up not happening. I mean, I think that there's enough, you know, I don't know if cooler heads is the right one, but smart people, I don't know if that's the right word either. But in the end, I think that Congress and the administration will find a way to find a deal that works for everybody. And again, sequestration may happen for a week, a month. Well, maybe not a month, a week, a couple of days, but they'll eventually get it done.
The stack up that we're looking at then is something, Dan, I guess I shouldn't use the term, it's not something we should worry about because it's interesting and has potentially negative impact if all these dominoes fall. But it sounds like that maybe you think we should just not fixate on it as much as we do.
Well,
is that fair to say?
Clearly, Congress and the administration have set a deadline that they have extended now for 2 months in the legislation that passed at the end of basically at the turn of the year. And they have to take that deadline seriously. And understanding, and this gets back to the conversation we had earlier in the hour, understanding what steps agencies can take, what steps the administration can take to identify paths forward that are sensible, that basically say, all right, we've only got X dollars. Next year we might have, as Jason said, next year we might have X minus 5% or whatever the number is. Here's how we're going to plan. And then for agencies to present that to the administration, and then for the administration to discuss that with Congress, hopefully will occur much more often over the next couple of months.
All right, I have a deadline we have to take seriously, too, and that is the end of the program.
There's so much more.
Boy, we could do a whole nother hour just on this, but we have to wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown. Thank you very much, Dan. Great to see you, as always. And Jason, thank you as well. Dan Chenick, the Executive Director of the IBM Center for the Business of Government, my colleague Jason Miller, all of the stories selected in the countdown available on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and hour number two of the program comes next.